Welcome to Discovery's podcast. We're glad you're joining us today. If you'd like to know more about us, you can check out our website, dc2.me, or follow along on our socials. And now, here is this week's sermon.
To you. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here, and thought it would be helpful for those that have called Discovery home for a little bit, before we got into today's teaching, just to pause, and I don't know if you're prone to practices like this in a new year, but to stop and look backward and go, what happened last year? And for us as a church, what have we learned? Every year as we craft the upcoming year's sermon calendar, which right now we have everything that's loosely held but planned through about next November. About this time last year, we were getting everything ready to go. And then the hope of every calendar year here at Discovery is minimum half the year we're just studying the Word, just what's a book of the Bible. We're honed in on that. And then there's also this aspect of shepherding and practicing church community together, where studying more topical things is really helpful. And so I just wanted to take us through a tour of this last year. If you're newer to Discovery, you're like, I wasn't here for any of this, I would just love for you to see some of the way that we do craft and put together a calendar year. So at this time last year, we were celebrating Christmastide right before rolling into a series on heaven. And heaven, I think, is one of those ideas that we don't think about nearly enough. And if it would, it would continue to change how we live every single day. And so we spent some time there, but then immediately jumped into the book of 1 Peter. 1 Peter was a letter that was written to a first century church, a group of Christians living in a time of deep persecution in the Roman Empire. As this group of Christians is trying to figure out, how do we keep this vision of heaven and where we're headed? Well, we're just experiencing so much suffering and grief. From there, we took a nice long tour into what we call the essentials. Here at Discovery, we hold to loosely to the Nicene Creed. And through that series, different pieces of artwork were put up on the walls. If you have not yet, I cannot encourage you enough. The little QR codes on the bottom of the walls over here will walk you through each piece of artwork and the meaning and the metaphor that was put into each one of those by our friend Beth Longtine. What a gift as we explored these essentials. From there, we jumped into a short series called Naming the Elephant as we walked through topics of shame and anxiety and sexuality and my personal favorite sermon of the year with my friend Brian Davis, some thoughts on contentment. What does it mean to be content in a culture that continues to tell you you don't have enough, you are not enough? And that led us into a few weeks talking about money. From there, we got into summer's hottest read, studying the book of Leviticus, because we're gluttons for punishment around our preaching team. And it was lovely. The book of Leviticus is a book written to the priests. And it walks them through not just, here's a whole bunch of rules, but really it's helping these priests understand, how does atonement work? This fancy Bible word, atonement, that really just means, how do you get right with God? How do you be right with each other? And as priests, your job is not just to figure that out for yourselves, but to walk with the community around you as you help them navigate what that looks like. From Leviticus, we had a real short time as we were looking at prayer, leading up to a week of prayer with our friends at the 24/7 prayer movement. Absolutely so much fun. And then we were into a couple weeks talking about our catchphrases here at Discovery. No matter what you've done or what's been done to you, you're welcome here. You can belong before you believe. And then we wrapped up the typical calendar year studying the book of Zechariah, this book that was written to the nation of Israel as they're coming back from their exile in Babylon, trying to figure out, what do we do? The city's in shambles, our hope is tenuous at best, and a book that continues to evoke this future idea of there is a coming hero, a coming savior. And as we explored that in those final chapters, we landed gracefully on the doorstep of Advent, where we've been enjoying the book of John for this last several weeks. We've been preparing for him. On Christmas Eve, we got to celebrate his coming. At midnight mass, we got to celebrate that he was finally home. For those that were here, you recognize this. But if there's a way to capture the metaphor of what John's doing in this book, it is a practical, physical manger with a very abstract light. This is the book of John, so far in the introduction. But we've welcomed him home to us, to be with us. We've welcomed him into our homes. And since Christmas, we've been enjoying Christmastide that Drew alluded to earlier. It's this idea that we're receiving company. It's not that Jesus was simply coming by to drop off a gift like some Amazon delivery driver, but he was bringing with him luggage to come into your home and to stay with you for a while. And for those who still have your trees up or still have lights on the house, Tuesday is the 12th day of Christmas. Keep those suckers up guilt-free. And then after that, you can figure it out in your own home when's the right time to pull that down. But keep lighting candles. Keep savoring this time of year. I think as I get older, the reason why I love Christmastide so much is because it takes away the focus on the event of Christmas and allows me and invites me into a space of contemplation and receiving and remaining curious. It's a long, lingering celebration. So as we celebrate these last sips of Christmastide, this will be our last Sunday there, we get to finish today the last bits of John's introduction to his book. These first 18 verses really are known as the prologue. It's just, here's how he launches this thing. And there's a lot that we've covered so far. If somebody asks you, hey, what's the beginning of John about? What's he covering in this introduction? You could talk about how in his first lines, he's mimicking the book of Genesis with his phrase, in the beginning. You could wax philosophical, literally, about his use of the word logos, so the use of the word word, and how he layers the meanings in such delicate and elegant ways so that he can hit as many people in the crowd as he can. You could be a little bit more creative than that, too, if you wanted to talk about what's the beginning of this book about. My New Testament professor in seminary was a guy by the name of Dale Bruner, and he liked to describe it like this. He got asked, a solid seminary professor, not a preacher, and he liked to say, I don't have the gift of preaching, I don't have the gift of hospitality, I have the gift of an iron butt. And what he meant by that is he would sit in the library for about 12 hours a day. That's what Fuller Seminary paid him to do, just sit in here and research and write commentaries. He loved being there so much, his wife would have to come and call him for dinner. Like he wouldn't pick up a phone, he wouldn't have a phone. She'd have to just wander in the library and figure out where he was to bring him home. He just loved sitting in the library. That's Dale Bruner. Well, he was at this church, this Presbyterian church in Spokane, Washington, and their lead pastor takes a call to a different church down in Texas. And so they're looking for an itinerant preacher just for a couple months, and they tap Dale on the shoulder and say, well, you're a Bible guy. Why don't you do the preaching for a couple months? And he's terrified. And in his commentary on the book of John, he recounts this story a little bit. I'm going to risk a little bit and read this to you. If this doesn't go well, I'll not do this for second service, and you can come back and hear it again the second time. But this is how Dale Bruner starts engaging preaching the book of John. But I desperately needed illustrations if the congregation was not to fall asleep on me. What to do? And then I recalled having read in a German newspaper editorial, this guy, that a characteristic feature of American Western movies was that the cowboy hero always came from outside the town. I thought to myself, that's exactly what John's prologue is saying about the God who, outside us, came into town with us. If this editorial observation is true, I'll have an illustration and maybe even two. I went to Blockbuster and checked out Blockbuster. Four classic westerns, High Noon with Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly from 1952, Shane with Alan Ladd from 1953, Jeremiah Johnson with the now late Robert Redford, 1972, and Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood, 1992. I would have to watch only the opening scenes to see if, in fact, the hero did come from outside town. I remember watching Shane first, and I was thrilled by what happened in the opening scene when the bad guys came riding up to Mr. Strait's house and ordered him to leave town. Alan Ladd suddenly appeared on the screen alongside Mr. Strait and told the bad guys to leave town. This is what the bad guys said to Alan Ladd. Who are you, stranger? And he said something like, I'm a friend of Mr. Strait's here, and you get out. Yeah. Jeremiah Johnson begins with Robert Redford coming off the riverboat in a Midwestern town, and the movie's initial voiceover says, his name was Jeremiah Johnson. He wanted to be a mountain man. Nobody knows his whereabouts, but that didn't seem to matter. That's all I had to hear or see. Nobody knew his whereabouts. He's a mysterious outsider. Again, the common Western and prologue motif, exactly. Finally, in Unforgiven, after a morally rather difficult to take introduction, someone in town comes calling on Clint Eastwood at his hog farm outside town to ask him to come into town and help. Again, that was all I needed to know. Conclusion, is the Western hero from outside town an echo of the prologue's seminal out-of-towner? I would like to learn about this mysterious correlation. I've seen only a handful of Western movies since, but in every one of them, if I recall correctly, the hero has indeed come from outside town. And then he says this: the hero of our gospel came from outside town too. Did the Hollywood Westerns pick up this theme from the gospel, or more simply, is the necessity of outside help for the human predicament imprinted deep inside the human genome? If you want to sum up what we've covered so far, you could say, oh, Genesis. You say, oh, Logos. You could also just sum it up by saying, oh, it's a classic Western, this book of John. The townspeople are in trouble, and the hero is beginning to ride into town. Westerns are fun. It's one of the earliest movie genres. They've bled into so many other genres. But as a narrative arc, they only work if one thing is true. There's a problem. Trouble's brewing. Thugs are stealing horses. Women and children are being abused. Those in charge of justice are practicing evil and oppression. This is a helpful way to describe John. But this isn't a distant story. This is personal for John, and it's intended to be personal for us. So the key question that we'll sit with today as we finish the introduction is this: how are you in trouble? Some troubles are universal. Our bodies are in trouble. The survival rate in these suckers isn't all that great. I don't know if you've noticed that. Some troubles are unique. Addiction, maybe that's obvious. Alcohol, drugs, pornography. But maybe the trouble's a little quieter. Maybe it's trouble that you have with money in either direction. I love it too much. I don't have enough. Maybe the trouble is I'm trying to control everything in my life. Or I need approval just to survive the day. Or I'm grasping for any sense of security I can find. For some, the trouble is far more practical. You'd love to have bills to pay, but you can't even stay in a home. What trouble are you in? Underneath it all is something that, again, we all share. It's this fundamental truth of the human genome, as Bruner puts it, that we're messed up. Our stories and our choices are leading us towards anything but life. We're like a town that's plagued with problems that we aren't solving, and in many cases, we're actually making them worse. As Bruner begins to intimate, perhaps the problem is not simply in town, but inside our very selves. The trouble is as much internal as it is external. So to help us understand why answering that question is important, we're now ready to jump into today's verses. And we're at the end of this introduction to John, John chapter 1. If you brought your Bibles, you can turn there. For those that call Discovery home, particularly for those of you that are like, I call myself a follower of Jesus, we're going to be in the book of John until about the beginning of May. I would love to invite you. This is one of the most complex and intricate books ever written. I would love for you to bring your Bible if you have one. And if you don't have one and want one, please come find me. I'd love to give you one today. But the ways that we're going to continue to track connections that John's making, not just within his own book, which is mind-blowing, but connections that he's making all over the whole text of the Bible, it's incredible. Please bring your books with you. This will be so helpful in your own engagement with the text going on. Okay, today, John chapter 1, we're in verses 16 through 18, just three little verses. It says this: from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. All right, we're going to break this a little bit apart as we just go through piece by piece today. What is he saying here? We left off at our Christmas Eve sermon with this line from John 1:14. John wrote this: we've seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. And now John's saying this, and we're connecting this idea of fullness. From his fullness, verse 16, we have all received grace upon grace. So what is his glory, and why is it full of grace and truth? These are like, it sounds really nice and flowery. That sounds like words that you say in church. What does that mean? Full of grace and truth, his glory. The story that we're about to read is going to include some wild moments. Jesus is about to perform miracles. He's about to heal people. He's about to teach some mind-blowing lessons. And ultimately, this main character, will be brutally killed and incredibly come back to life, and he will ascend to heaven, back to the right hand of the Father. But the glory of this story is not simply the account of what Jesus did. The glory is that this story, this character, is an explanation of God's attitude towards people and his purposes for them. John is looking at this character going, he's about to expose us to the answer to every question we're all asking all the time. The glory here means that God has made a way back to himself, back to the world he originally created. He's healed things back to pure goodness. And John, as John will say in a different book, in the book of Revelation, to a place and a point that there's no more death, and there's no more mourning, and there's no more crying, and there's no more pain. What's the glory of Jesus? It's that with his life, he paved the road for us to be back into the goodness of a life with God, instead of being at odds with him and with his kingdom. And that's not just a promise for someday, that you like, someday maybe heaven happens. That's a reality that begins right now, a kingdom that's available to you in the present tense. And so as Jesus rides into town, he confronts evil, he restores order, they saw it happen, and from his fullness they receive grace upon grace, as John says it. John says that grace isn't new, which I think is really fun for us as readers, particularly of the New Testament. John's pointing out God has always helped. If you could boil down, especially with this idea of a classic Western in mind, what does grace mean? It means help that's offered from a hero to the hurting, particularly if they haven't deserved it. And as we read this book, I mean, you get to like page 3. It's literally the third chapter, where things just go totally haywire. And in the moments, like as the haywire is happening, and in every page since, you get this continued insight and invitation that this God character that's in here, he's not done trying to pave this road back to himself. He's not done trying to reclaim this relationship. What John's getting at here, this idea of we've received grace upon grace, he's saying, look, we've been given grace a lot. Have you read the Old Testament? Grace is all over that thing. You can oversimplify it, like kind of how John is here by saying it's the Ten Commandments, but really when he talks about Moses here, grace was given, the law was given to Moses. He's talking about the first 5 books of the Old Testament. Grace is in these books. Leviticus is a book of grace. The Ten Commandments are a gift of grace. It's not a story about an angry God, but a helping God, and John's pointing this out. He's also being very clear here. He's not saying, and then this Jesus comes and he's more of the same. No. For John, Jesus is a completely new day. He uses this word fullness on purpose. The Old Testament offered real and beautiful pieces of grace. They were like fragments of a sculpture or pieces of a puzzle. But with Jesus, the picture is complete. Grace is finished. The hero's work is done. From his fullness, you have access to endless grace. Forgiveness before you even know you need it. Healing before you even know you're wounded. The commentary writer F.F. Bruce would say it like this: the plentitude of divine goodness and glory that resides in Christ is an ocean from which all his people may draw without ever diminishing its content. That's good. And when we get this amazing nugget in the final words in John 1:18, John's going to say this: no one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. I stumbled across this in the first commentary that I was reading this last week, and then it came up in the next one, and the next one. And at first I thought it was just cute, and then as I kept seeing it come up over and over again, I'm like, oh, they're serious. This is like a real thing that John's up to. The Greek here, the phrase that's used for this idea of close to the Father's heart, that's the same phrase that John's going to use later, I think it's in chapter 13, at the Last Supper, for the phrase that John's describing himself with as, I'm eating with Jesus and I'm leaning on his bosom, is how it'll put it in the English. But at Middle Eastern dining tables, many of you probably know this, the tables are very low to the ground and you'll sit on cushions. But usually it's not so simple to say that you're sitting, but you're actually like, you're kind of like a round table of fallen dominoes. Like you're all leaning on each other. Like you've got somebody leaning on you and you're leaning on somebody else. At this Last Supper, John is sitting next to Jesus and he's leaning onto Jesus as they're eating. You eat with your right hand. And you can like suspect some things about dining in this kind of an environment. You'd probably hope for somebody like me, someone with a little more cushion to them as opposed to a bony Middle Eastern carpenter. No offense, Jesus. Your body would rise and fall as they breathed, as you're eating your meal. If you turned to face them, you would practically be forehead to forehead, looking directly into their eyes. You can't get much closer than that. And if the chef for the night used a lot of garlic, you would be the first one to know. So here we have John in the same way, saying the same phrase. Here we have this Jesus whose natural place is reclining onto the lap of God. This character Jesus, he doesn't just abstractly understand the philosophy and the theology of God. God's not just a series of bullet points and ideas to Jesus that he's coming to give us the quick outline. He knows God intimately. Metaphorically, he knows what his breath smells like and the color of his eyes and the frequency with which he breathes and exhales. He knows him like that. You can't get much closer than that. And John, this gospel writer, is making it plain. That Jesus, whose natural position to God is that close, that Jesus is coming to share what God is like with us. To make him known to us. Can you imagine the level of detail we should expect to hear? And for a bunch of townspeople with a lot of external trouble and a lot of internal trouble, the thought of getting to see and to learn about and even personally know this hero who's coming from out of town, that's interesting. What's he going to tell us? And it brings us back to our basic question, how are you in trouble? If you're finding yourself in the early January of 2026 going, I'm not in that much trouble, life's actually okay, I just want to warn you, this story may not move you all that much, but I would gently ask, are you sure? Or are you under the anesthesia of seeming comfort or wealth or health, or have you just smeared a little too thickly the idea of, well, everybody makes mistakes in ways that are actually hurting you? These are all temporary blindfolds preventing you from seeing the fullness of a more honest reality that things are not okay. And there's another warning I have as we begin to descend further into the book of John. This story also won't make sense if you only see yourself as the one being rescued. Jesus invites those that he is hanging out with to join him. In Westerns, he appoints new deputies. He teaches them the law. He asks them to keep the peace in town. His grace is received in these books, but then it's expected to then be offered onward. And so if you want grace but not that responsibility, you may also miss out on some of the depth and the richness of this book. But if you're in trouble, if you know the ways you're in trouble, as you look out into the town and the townspeople and the world around you and you see trouble, as you look into the mirror and into the pages of a journal and into the quiet moments as you drive to and from work or the grocery store, and you're willing to descend into the depths to realize that internally, I am not well. Oh, this book is delightful. And it will change your life. And it will reveal to you a purpose that is so much better than anything this world's going to try and sell you. So are you in? Do you want to keep reading this book? Like, honestly. The invitation of Christmas tide is simple. This child has been born. Do you want to draw near to this child? Do you want to hold him? Do you want to snug your nose up next to him and nuzzle him? Do you want to be with him? It's a really easy question that is very difficult to answer, if you're honest. But this invitation is for you. It's for the townspeople. Brennan Manning, in his book, The Ragamuffin Gospel, says it like this. I'm going to read the first half of this quote. It's rather long, but then we'll read on the screen together the last half. He says this: "The gospel is not for the super spiritual. It's not for the muscular Christians who have made John Wayne and not Jesus their hero. It is not for the academicians who would imprison Jesus in the ivory tower of exegesis. It's not for noisy, feel-good folks who manipulate Christianity into a naked appeal to emotion. It's not for the hooded mystics who want their magic in their religion. And it's not for the Alleluia Christians who only live on the mountaintop and have never visited the valley of grief and desolation. It's not for the fearless and the tearless. It's not for the red-hot zealots who boast with the rich young ruler of the Gospels, 'All these commandments I have kept from my youth.' It's not for the complacent, hoisting over their shoulder a tote bag of honors and diplomas and good works, actually believing they have made it. It's not for legalists who would rather surrender control of their souls to rules than to run the risk of living in union with God." And then he says this: "The gospel's for the bedraggled, the beat up, and the burnout. It is for the sorely burdened who are still shifting the heaven suitcase from one hand to the other. It's for the wobbly and weak-kneed who know they don't have it all together and are too proud to accept the handout of amazing grace. It's for the inconsistent, the unsteady disciples whose cheese is falling off their cracker. It's for the poor and the weak and the sinful men and women. It's for the bent and the bruised who feel that their lives are a grave disappointment to God. It's for smart people who know that they're stupid and honest disciples who admit they're scalawags. I still don't understand what he means by the cheese falling off the cracker line. Do you see yourself in this list? As we look back on last year and begin a new year together, as we descend into the depths of this book, it's a classic Western. And if your town and if your soul is not in trouble, I worry that you'll miss the story. And the more in touch you are with your trouble, the more you understand your foolishness, the more you understand how much of a scalawag you are. I thought it was scallywag. I guess it's scalawag. The more the trouble is not just on the outside, but you recognize it on your insides. And the more the story will change your life. So how are you in trouble? And maybe just as important, how do you spend time considering it? As we think about how to engage this thought today, just a couple thoughts. For those of you that keep a rule of life, and if this is a new concept to you, 2 years ago, we spent a sermon series talking about what this means, this idea of a rule of life. But I'd love to encourage you, what role does confession play in your regular rhythm of spending time with the Lord? If that's not something you're used to, out on the windmill, out in the lobby by the coffee, you can grab one of these sheets that will just walk you through how to practice confession. For those that don't keep a rule of life, it's really the same question. How do you just stay aware of your sin and your brokenness instead of smearing a thin veneer of ignorance over them as you keep calm and carry on? And then, the best I have to offer by way of how do you engage a story like this is the practice of how do you receive forgiveness? Because the point of this character of Jesus is not that he would come and say, "Look at what you've done. Suffer in shame and grief. And maybe if you suffer long enough and if your knees are bloodied enough, I'll think about hanging out with you." This is a story of a God who says, "It won't be good news and it won't be forgiveness if you won't give it to me. But if you give it to me, I forgive you. You don't have to carry this around with you anymore. You get a fresh start." So how do you practice giving it to him? But just as important in that movement is how do you practice receiving life back from him? Is this a meaningful part of your monthly, daily, weekly experience? And I have to implore you as a friend, don't brush these practices off as familiar or as super spiritual. We're studying this book for the next 5 months. If you can be tapped into your own trouble, your sin and your sickness and your brokenness, if you can be willing to engage this, the reality of this character will continue to make more and more sense to your daily reality. Could it be that this character, who is full, like an ocean that you cannot take enough water out of, he's full of grace and truth. Could it be that he's coming to your rescue? So as we wrap up this introduction to John, what's this book about? It's a Western. We're living in a town that's being run by thugs who like to abuse, and who like to torture, and who like to twist. And we're yearning for a hero. And in this first chapter of this Western, John is saying, look to the hill. Do you see the silhouette at dusk? Here he comes. As we think about this practice of offering to God, here's my mess, here's my trouble, and receiving forgiveness and fullness from him, I'm going to hand it off to Drew to take us into our next element.